in a whirlwind of his cries, his human smell, and all the remembered scents mingled with it, the afternoon sunshine on a wooden table, the red wine, the smoke of the little fire. "Lestat! Do you hear me, Lestat?" Thunder of fists against the door. Memory of childhood fairy tale. The giant says he smells the blood of a human in his lair. Horror. I knew the giant was going to find the human. I could hear him coming after the human, step by step. I was the human. Only no more. Smoke and salt and flesh and pumping blood. "This is the witch's place, Lestat, do you hear me? This is the witch's place." Dull tremor of the old secrets between us. The love, the things that only we had known, felt. Dancing in the witch's place. Can you deny it? Can you deny everything that passed between us? Get him out of France. Send him to the new world. And then what? All his life he is one of those slightly interesting but generally tiresome mortals who have seen spirits, talk of them incessantly, and no one believes him. Deepening madness. Will he be a comic lunatic, finally? The kind that even the ruffians and bullies look after, playing his fiddle in a dirty coat for the crowds on the streets of Port-au-Prince? "Be the puppeteer again," she had said. "Is that what I was? No one will ever believe his mad tales." "But he knows the place where we lie, Mother. He knows our names, the name of our kin, too many things about us, and he will never go quietly to another country. And they may go after him. They will never let him live now. Where are they?" I went up the stairs in the whirlwind of his echoing cries, looking out the little barred window at the open land. They'll be coming again. They have to come. First I was alone, then I had her with me, and now I have them. But what was the crux? That he wanted it? That he had screamed over and over that I denied him the power? Or was it that I now had the excuses I needed to bring him to me as I had wanted to do from the first moment? My Nicholas. My love. Eternity waits. All the great and splendid pleasures of being dead. I went further up the stairs towards him, and the thirst sang in me. To hell with his cries. The thirst sang, and I was an instrument of its singing. And his cries had become inarticulate, the pure essence of his curses, a dull punctuating to the misery that I could hear without need of any sound. Something divinely carnal in the broken syllables coming from his lips, like the low gush of blood through his heart. I lifted the key and put it in the lock, and he went silent, his thoughts washing backwards and into him as if the ocean could be sucked back into the tiny mysterious coils of a single shell. I tried to see him in the shadows of the room, and not it. The love for him, the aching, wrenching months of longing for him, the hideous and unshakable human need for him, the lust. I tried to see the mortal who didn't know what he was saying as he glared at me. "You and your talk of goodness," a low, seething voice, eyes glittering. "Your talk of good and evil, your talk of what was right and what was wrong, and death, oh yes, death, the horror, the tragedy." Words, born on the ever-swelling current of hatred, like flowers opening in the current, petals peeling back, then falling apart. "And you shared it with her? The Lord's Son giveth to the Lord's wife his great gift, the dark gift. Those who live in the castle share the dark gift. Never were they dragged to the witch's place, where the human grease pools on the ground at the foot of the burnt stake. No. Kill the old crone who can no longer see to sow, and the idiot boy who cannot till the field. And what does he give us, the Lord's Son, the wolf-killer, the one who screamed in the witch's place? Coin of the realm. That's good enough for us." Shuddering. Shirt soaked with sweat, gleam of taut flesh through the torn lace. Tantalizing, the mere sight of it. The narrow, tightly muscled torso that sculptors so love to represent, nipples pink against the dark skin. "This power, sputtering as if all day long he had been saying the words over with the same intensity, and it does not really matter that now I am present. This power that made all the lies meaningless, this dark power that soared over everything, this truth that obliterated... No, language, no truth. The wine bottles were empty, the food devoured. His lean arms were hardened and tense for the struggle. But what struggle? His brown hair fallen out of its ribbon, his eyes enormous and glazed. But suddenly he pushed against the wall, as if he'd go through it to get away from me. Dim remembrance of their drinking from him, the paralysis, the ecstasy. Yet he was drawn immediately forward again, staggering, putting his hands out to steady himself by taking hold of things that were not there. But his voice had stopped, something breaking in his face. "How could you keep it from me?" he whispered. Thoughts of old magic, luminous legend, some great eerie strata in which all the shadowy things thrived, an intoxication with forbidden knowledge in which the natural things became unimportant. No miracle any more to the leaves falling from the autumn trees, the sun in the orchard. No. The scent was rising from him like incense, like the heat and the smoke of church candles rising, heart thumping under the skin of his naked chest, tight little belly glistening with sweat, sweat staining the thick leather belt, blood full of salt. I could scarce breathe. And we do breathe. We breathe, and we taste, and we smell, and we feel, and we thirst. "You have misunderstood everything." Is this Lestat speaking? It sounded like some other demon, some loathsome thing for whom the voice was the imitation of a human voice. "You have misunderstood everything you have seen and heard." "I would have shared anything I possessed with you." Rage building again, he reached out. "It was you who never understood," he whispered. "Take your life and leave with it. Run!" "Don't you see it's the confirmation of everything? That it exists is the confirmation. Pure evil, sublime evil." Triumph in his eyes. He reached out suddenly and closed his hand on my face. "Don't taunt me," I said. I struck him so hard he fell backwards, chastened, silent. "When it was offered me, I said no. I tell you, I said no. With my last breath, I said no." "You were always the fool," he said. "I told you that." But he was breaking down. He was shuddering, and the rage was alchemizing into desperation. He lifted his arms again and then stopped. "You believed things that didn't matter," he said almost gently. "There was something you failed to see. Is it impossible you don't know yourself what you possess now?" The glaze over his eyes broke instantly into tears. His face knotted, unspoken words coming from him of love. And an awful self-consciousness came over me. Silent and lethal, I felt myself flooded with the power I had over him and his knowledge of it, and my love for him heated the sense of power, driving it towards a scorching embarrassment which suddenly changed into something else. We were in the wings of the theatre again. We were in the village in Auvergne, in that little inn. I smelled not merely the blood in him, but the sudden terror. He had taken a step back, and the very movement stoked the blaze in me as much as the vision of his stricken face. He grew smaller, more fragile. Yet he never seemed stronger, more alluring than he was now. All the expression drained from his face as I drew nearer. His eyes were wondrously clear, and his mind was opening as Gabrielle's mind had opened, and for one tiny second there flared a moment of us together in the garret, talking and talking as the moon glared on the snow-covered roofs, or walking through the Paris streets, passing the wine back and forth, heads bowed against the first gust of winter rain, and there had been the eternity of growing up and growing old before us, and so much joy even in misery, even in the misery. The real eternity. The real forever, the mortal mystery of that. but the moment faded in the shimmering expression on his face. "Come to me, Nicky," I whispered. I lifted both hands to beckon. "If you want it, you must come." I saw a bird soaring out of a cave above the open sea, and there was something terrifying about the bird and the endless waves over which it flew. Higher and higher it went, and the sky turned to silver, and then gradually the silver faded and the sky went dark. The darkness of evening, nothing to fear, really, nothing. Blessed darkness. But it was falling gradually and inexorably over nothing save this one tiny creature, cawing in the wind above a great wasteland that was the world. Empty caves, empty sands, empty sea. All I had ever loved to look upon, or listen to, or felt with my hands, was gone, or never existed. And the bird, circling and gliding, flew on and on, upwards past me, or more truly past no one, holding the entire landscape, without history or meaning, in the flat blackness of one tiny eye. I screamed, but without a sound. I felt my mouth full of blood, and each swallow passing down my throat and into fathomless thirst. And I wanted to say, "Yes, I understand now. I understand how terrible, how unbearable this darkness." I didn't know, couldn't know. The bird sailing on through the darkness over the barren shore, the seamless sea. Dear God, stop it! Worse than the horror in the inn, worse than the helpless trumpeting of the fallen horse in the snow. But the blood was the blood, after all, and the heart, the luscious heart, that was all hearts, was right there, on tiptoe against my lips. Now, my love, now's the moment. I can swallow the life that beats from your heart, and send you into the oblivion in which nothing may ever be understood or forgiven, or I can bring you to me. I pushed him backwards. I held him to me like a crushed thing, but the vision wouldn't stop. His arms slipped around my neck, his face wet, eyes rolling up into his head. Then his tongue shot out. It licked hard at the gash I had made for him in my own throat. Yes, eager. But please stop this vision. Stop the upward flight and the great slant of the colourless landscape, the cawing that meant nothing over the howl of the wind. The pain is nothing compared to this darkness. I don't want to. I don't want to. But it was dissolving, slowly dissolving. And finally it was finished. The veil of silence had come down, as it had with her. Silence. He was separate, and I was holding him away from me, and he was almost falling, his hands to his mouth, the blood running down his chin in rivulets. His mouth was open, and a dry sound came out of it, in spite of the blood, a dry scream. And beyond him, and beyond the remembered vision of the metallic sea and the lone bird who was its only witness, I saw her in the doorway, and her hair was a Virgin Mary veil of gold around her shoulders, and she said with the saddest expression on her face, "Disaster, my son." By midnight it was clear that he would not speak or answer to any voice, or move of his own volition. He remained still and expressionless in the places to which he was taken. If the death pained him, he gave no sign. If the new vision delighted him, he kept it to himself. Not even the thirst moved him. And it was Gabrielle who, after studying him quietly for hours, took him in hand, cleaning him and putting new clothes on him. Black wool she chose, one of the few sombre coats I owned, and modest linen that made him look oddly like a young cleric, a little too serious, a little naive. And in the silence of the crypt, as I watched them, I knew without doubt that they could hear each other's thoughts. Without a word she guided him through the grooming. Without a word she sent him back to the bench by the fire. Finally, she said, he should hunt now. and when she glanced at him, he rose without looking at her as if pulled by a string. Numbly I watched them going, heard their feet on the stairs, and then I crept up after them, stealthily, and holding to the bars of the gate, I watched them move, two feline spirits, across the field. The emptiness of the night was an indissoluble cold settling over me, closing me in. Not even the fire on the hearth warmed me when I returned to it. Emptiness here, and the quiet I had told myself that I wanted, just to be alone after the grisly struggle in Paris. Quiet, and the realization gnawing at my insides like a starved animal, that I couldn't stand the sight of him now. 5. When I opened my eyes the next night, I knew what I meant to do. Whether or not I could stand to look at him wasn't important. I had made him this, and I had to rouse him from his stupor somehow. The hunt hadn't changed him, though apparently he'd drunk and killed well enough. And now it was up to me to protect him from the revulsion I felt, and to go into Paris and get the one thing that might bring him around. The violin was all he'd ever loved when he was alive. Maybe now it would awaken him. I'd put it in his hands, and he'd want to play it again. He'd want to play it with his new skill, and everything would change, and the chill in my heart would somehow melt. As soon as Gabrielle rose, I told her what I meant to do. "But what about the others?" she said. "You can't go riding into Paris alone." "Yes, I can," I said. "You're needed here with him. If the little pests should come round, they could lure him into the open the way he is now. And besides, I want to know what's happening under Les Innocents. If we have a real truce, I want to know." "I don't like your going," she said, shaking her head. "I tell you, if I didn't believe we should speak to the leader again, that we had things to learn from him and the old woman, I'd be leaving for Paris tonight."
"And what could they possibly teach us?" I said coldly. "That the sun really revolves around the earth? That the earth is flat?"
But the bitterness of my words made me feel ashamed. One thing they could tell me was why the vampires I'd made could hear each other's thoughts when I could not. But I was too crestfallen over my loathing of Nicky to think of all these things. I only looked at her and thought how glorious it had been to see the dark trick work its magic in her, to see it restore her youthful beauty, render her again the goddess she'd been to me when I was a little child. To see Nicky change had been to see him die. Maybe without reading the words in my soul she understood it only too well. We embraced slowly.
"Be careful," she said.
I should have gone to the flat right away to look for his violin, and there was still my poor Roger to deal with, lies to tell. And this matter of getting out of Paris, it seemed more and more the thing for us to do. But for hours I did just what I wanted. I hunted the Tuileries and the boulevards, pretending there was no coven under Les Innocents, that Nicky was alive still and safe somewhere, that Paris was all mine again. But I was listening for them every moment. I was thinking about the old queen, and I heard them when I least expected it, on the Boulevard du Temple, as I drew near to Renaud's. Strange that they'd be in the places of light, as they called them. But within seconds, I knew that several of them were hiding behind the theatre. And there was no malice this time, only a desperate excitement when they sensed that I was near. Then I saw the white face of the woman vampire, the dark-eyed pretty one with the witch's hair. She was in the alleyway beside the stage door, and she darted forward to beckon to me. I rode back and forth for a few moments. The boulevard was the usual spring evening panorama, hundreds of strollers amid the stream of carriage traffic, lots of street musicians, jugglers and tumblers, the lighted theatres with their doors open to invite the crowd. Why should I leave it to talk to these creatures? I listened. There were four of them, actually, and they were desperately waiting for me to come. They were in terrible fear. All right. I turned the horse and rode into the alley and all the way to the back, where they hovered together against the stone wall. The grey-eyed boy was there, which surprised me,
and he had a dazed expression on his face. A tall, blonde, male vampire stood behind him with a handsome woman, both of them swathed in rags like lepers. It was the pretty one, the dark-eyed one who had laughed at my little jest on the stairs under Les Innocents, who spoke.
"You have to help us," she whispered.
"I do?" I tried to steady the mare. She didn't like their company. "Why do I have to help you?" I demanded.
"He's destroying the coven," she said.
"Destroying us," the boy said, but he didn't look at me. He was staring at the stones in front of him, and from his mind I caught flashes of what was happening, of the pyre lighted, of Armand forcing his followers into the fire. I tried to get this out of my head, but the images were now coming from all of them. The dark-eyed pretty one looked directly into my eyes as she strove to sharpen the pictures, Armand swinging a great, charred beam of wood as he drove the others into the blaze, then stabbing them down into the flames with the beam as they struggled to escape.
"Good Lord, there were 12 of you," I said. "Couldn't you fight?"
"We did, and we are here," said the woman. "He burned 6 together and the rest of us fled. In terror, we sought strange resting places for the day. We had never done this before, slept away from our sacred graves. We didn't know what would happen to us. And when we rose, he was there. Another 2 he managed to destroy, so we are all that is left. He has even broken open the deep chambers and burned the starved ones. He has broken loose the earth to block the tunnels to our meeting place." The boy looked up slowly.
"You did this to us," he whispered. "You have brought us all down."
The woman stepped in front of him.
"You must help us," she said. "Make a new coven with us. Help us to exist as you exist."
She glanced impatiently at the boy. "But the old woman, the great one," I asked.
"It was she who commenced it," said the boy bitterly. "She threw herself into the fire. She said she would go to join Magnus. She was laughing. It was then that he drove the others into the flames as we fled."
I bowed my head. So she was gone. And all she had known and witnessed had gone with her. And what had she left behind but the simple one, the vengeful one, the wicked child who believed what she had known to be false?
"You must help us," said the dark-eyed woman. "You see, it's his right as Coven Master to destroy those who are weak, those who can't survive."
"He couldn't let the Coven fall into chaos," said the other woman vampire who stood behind the boy. "Without the faith in the dark ways, the others might have blundered, alarmed the mortal populace. But if you help us to form a new Coven, to perfect ourselves in new ways..."
"We are the strongest of the Coven," said the man. "And if we can fend him off long enough and manage to continue without him, then in time he may leave us alone."
"He will destroy us," the boy muttered.
"He will never leave us alone. He will lie in wait for the moment when we separate."
"He isn't invincible," said the tall male, "and he's lost all conviction, remember that."
"And you have Magnus's tower, a safe place," said the boy despairingly as he looked up at me.
"No, that I can't share with you," I said. "You have to win this battle on your own."
"But surely you can guide us," said the man.
"You don't need me," I said. "What have you already learned from my example? What did you learn from the things I said last night?"
"We learned more from what you said to him afterwards," said the dark-eyed woman. "We heard you speak to him of a new evil, an evil for these times destined to move through the world in handsome human guise."
"So take on the guise," I said. "Take the garments of your victims, and take the money from their pockets, and you can then move among mortals as I do. In time you can gain enough wealth to acquire your own little fortress, your secret sanctuary. Then you will no longer be beggars or ghosts." I could see the desperation in their faces. Yet they listened attentively.
"But our skin, the timbre of our voices," said the dark-eyed woman.
"You can fool mortals. It's very easy. It just takes a little skill."
"But how do we start?" said the boy dully, as if he were only reluctantly being brought into it. "What sort of mortals do we pretend to be?"
"Choose for yourself," I said. "Look around you.
Masquerade as gypsies, if you will. That oughtn't to be too difficult. Or better yet, mummers. I glanced towards the light of the boulevard.
Mummers, said the dark-eyed woman, with a little spark of excitement.
Yes, actors. Street performers. Acrobats. Make yourselves acrobats. Surely you've seen them out there. You can cover your white faces with grease paint, and your extravagant gestures and facial expressions won't even be noticed. You couldn't choose a more nearly perfect disguise than that. On the boulevard, you'll see every manner of mortal that dwells in this city. You'll learn all you need to know.
She laughed and glanced at the others. The man was deep in thought, the other woman musing, the boy unsure.
With your powers, you can become jugglers and tumblers easily, I said. It would be nothing for you. You could be seen by thousands who'd never guess what you are.
That isn't what happened with you on the stage of this little theater, said the boy coldly.
You put terror into their hearts.
Because I chose to do it, I said, tremor of pain. That's my tragedy. But I can fool anyone when I want to, and so can you.
I reached into my pockets and drew out a handful of gold crowns. I gave them to the dark-eyed woman. She took them in both hands and stared at them as if they were burning her. She looked up, and in her eyes I saw the image of myself on Renault's stage, performing those ghastly feats that had driven the crowd into the streets. But she had another thought in her mind. She knew the theatre was abandoned, that I'd sent the troupe off. And for one second I considered it, letting the pain double itself and pass through me, wondering if the others could feel it. What did it really matter, after all?
"Yes, please," said the pretty one.
She reached up and touched my hand with her cool white fingers.
"Let us inside the theatre. Please."
She turned and looked at the back doors of Renault's. "Let them inside. Let them dance on my grave." But there might be old costumes there still. The discarded trappings of a troupe that had had all the money in the world to buy itself new finery. Old pots of white paint, water still in the barrels, 1,000 treasures left behind in the haste of departure. I was numb, unable to consider all of it, unwilling to reach back to embrace all that had happened there.
"Very well," I said, looking away as if some little thing had distracted me. "You can go into the theatre if you wish. You can use whatever is there."
She drew closer and pressed her lips suddenly to the back of my hand.
"We won't forget this," she said. "My name is Eleni. This boy is Laurent. The man here is Félix, and the woman with him, Eugénie. If Armand moves against you, he moves against us."
"I hope you prosper," I said, and strangely enough, I meant it. I wondered if any of them, with all their dark ways and dark rituals, had ever really wanted this nightmare that we all shared. They'd been drawn into it as I had, really. And we were all children of darkness now, for better or worse. "But be wise in what you do here," I warned. "Never bring victims here or kill near here. Be clever and keep your hiding place safe." It was 3 o'clock before I rode over the bridge onto the Île Saint-Louis. I had wasted enough time, and now I had to find the violin. But as soon as I approached Nicky's house on the quay, I saw that something was wrong. The windows were empty. All the drapery had been pulled down, and yet the place was full of light, as if candles were burning inside by the hundreds. Most strange. Roger couldn't have taken possession of the flat yet. Not enough time had passed to assume that Nicky had met with foul play. Quickly I went up over the roof and down the wall to the courtyard window and saw that the drapery had been stripped away there, too. And candles were burning in all the candelabra and in the wall sconces, and some were even stuck in their own wax on the pianoforte and the desk. The room was in total disarray. Every book had been pulled off the shelf, and some of the books were in fragments, pages broken out. Even the music had been emptied, sheet by sheet, onto the carpet. And all the pictures were lying about on the tables with other small possessions, coins, money, keys. Perhaps the demons had wrecked the place when they took Nicky.
But who had lighted all these candles? It didn't make sense. I listened. No one in the flat, or so it seemed. But then I heard not thoughts, but tiny sounds. I narrowed my eyes for a moment, just concentrating, and it came to me that I was hearing pages turn, and then something being dropped. More pages turning. Stiff, old parchment pages. Then again the book dropped. I raised the window as quietly as I could. The little sounds continued, but no scent of human, no pulse of thought. Yet there was a smell here. Something stronger than the stale tobacco and the candle wax, the smell the vampires carried with them from the cemetery soil. More candles in the hallway, candles in the bedroom, and the same disarray, books open as they lay in careless piles, the bedclothes snarled, the pictures in a heap, cabinets emptied, drawers pulled out, and no violin anywhere, I managed to note that. And those little sounds coming from another room, pages being turned very fast. Whoever he was, and of course I knew who he had to be, he did not give a damn that I was there. He had not even stopped to take a breath. I went farther down the hall and stood in the door of the library and found myself staring right at him as he continued with his task. It was Armand, of course. Yet I was hardly prepared for the sight he presented here. Candle wax dripped down the marble bust of Caesar, flowed over the brightly painted countries of the world globe, and the books they lay in mountains on the carpet, save for those of the very last shelf in the corner where he stood, in his old rags still, hair full of dust, ignoring me as he ran his hand over page after page, his eyes intent on the words before him, his lips half open, his expression like that of an insect in its concentration as it chews through a leaf. Perfectly horrible he looked, actually. He was sucking everything out of the books. Finally, he let this one drop and took down another, and opened it, and started devouring it in the same manner, fingers moving down the sentences with preternatural speed. And I realized that he had been examining everything in the flat in this fashion, even the bedsheets and curtains, the pictures that had been taken off their hooks, the contents of cupboards and drawers. But from the books he was taking concentrated knowledge. Everything from Caesar's Gallic Wars to modern English novels lay on the floor. But his manner wasn't the entire horror. It was the havoc he was leaving behind him, the utter disregard of everything he used, and his utter disregard of me. He finished his last book, or broke off from it, and went to the old newspapers stacked on a lower shelf. I found myself backing out of the room and away from him, staring numbly at his small, dirty figure. His auburn hair shimmered despite the dirt in it. His eyes burned like two lights. Grotesque, he seemed, among all the candles and the swimming colours of the flat, this filthy waif of the netherworld, and yet his beauty held sway. He hadn't needed the shadows of Notre Dame or the torchlight of the crypt to flatter him. And there was a fierceness in him in this bright light that I hadn't seen before. I felt an overwhelming confusion. He was both dangerous and compelling. I could have looked on him forever. But an overpowering instinct said, "Get away. Leave the place to him if he wants it. What does it matter now?" The violin. I tried desperately to think about the violin, to stop watching the movement of his hands over the words in front of him, the relentless focus of his eyes. I turned my back on him and went into the parlour. My hands were trembling. I could hardly endure knowing he was there. I searched everywhere and didn't find the damned violin. What could Nicky have done with it? I couldn't think. Pages turning, paper crinkling, soft sound of the newspaper dropping to the floor. Go back to the tower at once. I went to pass the library quickly, when, without warning, his soundless voice shot out and stopped me. It was like a hand touching my throat. I turned and saw him staring at me. Do you love them, your silent children? Do they love you? That was what he asked, the sense disentangling itself from an endless echo. I felt the blood rise to my face. The heat spread out over me like a mask as I looked at him. All the books in the room were now on the floor. He was a haunt standing in the ruins, a visitant from the devil he believed in. Yet his face was so tender, so young. "The dark trick never brings love, you see. It brings only the silence." His voice seemed softer in its soundlessness, clearer, the echo dissipated. "We used to say it was Satan's will, that the master and the fledgling not seek comfort in each other. It was Satan who had to be served, after all." Every word penetrated me. Every word was received by a secret, humiliating curiosity and vulnerability, but I refused to let him see this. Angrily I said, "What do you want of me?" It was shattering something to speak. I was feeling more fear of him at this moment than ever during the earlier battles and arguments, and I hate those who make me feel fear, those who know things that I need to know, who have that power over me. "It is like not knowing how to read, isn't it?" he said aloud. "And your maker, the outcast, Magnus, what did he care for your ignorance? He did not tell you the simplest things, did he?" Nothing in his expression moved as he spoke. "Hasn't it always been this way? Has anyone ever cared to teach you anything?"
"You're taking these things from my mind," I said.
I was appalled. I saw the monastery where I'd been as a boy, the rows and rows of books that I could not read. Gabrielle bent over her books, her back to all of us. "Stop this," I whispered. It seemed the longest time had passed. I was becoming disoriented. He was speaking again, but in silence. "They never satisfy you, the ones you make. In silence, the estrangement and the resentment only grow." I willed myself to move, but I wasn't moving. I was merely looking at him as he went on. "You long for me, and I for you, and we alone in all this realm are worthy of each other. Don't you know this?" The toneless words seemed to be stretched, amplified, like a note on the violin drawn out forever and ever. "This is madness," I whispered. I thought of all the things he had said to me, what he had blamed me for, the horrors the others had described, that he had thrown his followers into the fire. "Is it madness?" he asked. "Go then to your silent ones. Even now they say to each other what they cannot say to you."
"You're lying," I said,
"and time will only strengthen their independence. But learn for yourself. You will find me easily enough when you want to come to me. After all, where can I go? What can I do? You have made me an orphan again." "I didn't," I said. "Yes, you did," he said. "You did it. You brought it down." Still there was no anger. "But I can wait for you to come. Wait for you to ask the questions that only I can answer." I stared at him for a long moment, I don't know how long. It was as if I couldn't move, and I couldn't see anything else but him, and the great sense of peace I'd known in Notre Dame, the spell he cast, was again working. The lights of the room were too bright. There was nothing else but light surrounding him, and it was as if he were coming closer to me, and I to him, yet neither of us was moving. He was drawing me. Drawing me towards him. I turned away, stumbling, losing my balance, but I was out of the room. I was running down the hallway, and then I was climbing out of the back window and up to the roof. I rode into the Ile de la Cité as if he were chasing me, and my heart didn't stop its frantic pace until I had left the city behind. Hell's bells ringing. The tower was in the darkness against the first glimmer of the morning light. My little coven had already gone to rest in their dungeon crypt. I didn't open the tombs to look at them, though I wanted desperately to do it, just to see Gabrielle and touch her hand. I climbed alone towards the battlements to look out at the burning miracle of the approaching morning, the thing I should never see to its finish again. Hell's bells ringing, my secret music. But another sound was coming to me. I knew it as I went up the stairs, and I marveled at its power to reach me. It was like a song arching over an immense distance, low and sweet. Once, years ago, I had heard a young farm boy singing as he walked along the high road out of the village to the north. He hadn't known anyone was listening. He had thought himself alone in the open country, and his voice had a private power and purity that gave it unearthly beauty. Never mind the words of his old song. This was the voice that was calling to me now. The lone voice, rising over the miles that separated us to gather all sounds into itself. I was frightened again. Yet I opened the door at the top of the staircase and went out onto the stone roof. Silken the morning breeze, dreamlike the twinkling of the last stars. The sky was not so much a canopy as it was a mist rising endlessly above me, and the stars drifted upwards, growing ever smaller in the mist. A faraway voice sharpened, like a note sung in the high mountains, touching my chest where I had laid my hand. It pierced me as a beam pierces darkness, singing, "Come to me! All things will be forgiven if only you come to me. I am more alone than I have ever been." And there came in time with the voice a sense of limitless possibility, of wonder and expectation that brought with it the vision of Armand standing alone in the open doors of Notre Dame. Time and space were illusions. He was in a pale wash of light before the main altar, a lissom shape in regal tatters, shimmering as he vanished, and nothing but patience in his eyes. There was no crypt under Les Innocents now. There was no grotesquerie of a ragged ghost in the glare of Nicky's library, throwing down the books when he had finished with them as if they were empty shells. I think I knelt down and rested my head against the jagged stones. I saw the moon like a phantom dissolving, and the sun must have touched her because she hurt me, and I had to close my eyes. But I felt an elation, an ecstasy. It was as if my spirit could know the glory of the dark trick without the blood flowing, in the intimacy of the voice dividing me and seeking the tenderest, most secret part of my soul. "What do you want of me?" I wanted to say again. How can there be this forgiveness when there was such rancor only a short while ago? Your coven destroyed. Horrors I don't want to imagine. I wanted to say it all again. But I couldn't shape the words now any more than I could before. And this time I knew that if I dared to try, the bliss would melt and leave me, and the anguish would be worse than the thirst for blood. Yet even as I remained still, in the mystery of this feeling, I knew strange images and thoughts that weren't my own. I saw myself retreat to the dungeon and lift up the inanimate bodies of those kindred monsters I loved. I saw myself carrying them up to the roof of the tower, and leaving them there in their helplessness at the mercy of the rising sun. Hell's bells rang the alarm in vain for them, and the sun took them up and made them cinders with human hair. My mind recoiled from this. It recoiled in the most heart-breaking disappointment. "Child, still," I whispered. Ah, the pain of this disappointment, the possibility diminishing. "How foolish you are to think that such things could be done by me." The voice faded. It withdrew itself from me, and I felt my aloneness in every pore of my skin. It was as if all covering had been taken from me forever, and I would always be as naked and miserable as I was now. And I felt far off a convulsion of power, as if the spirit that had made the voice was curling upon itself like a great tongue. "Treachery," I said louder. "But oh, the sadness of it! The miscalculation! How can you say that you desire me?" Gone it was, absolutely gone. and desperately I wanted it back, even if it was to fight with me. I wanted that sense of possibility, that lovely flare again. And I saw his face in Notre Dame, boyish and almost sweet, like the face of an old Da Vinci saint. A horrid sense of fatality passed over me.
6. As soon as Gabrielle rose, I drew her away from Nicky, out into the quiet of the forest, and I told her all that had taken place the preceding night. I told her all that Armand had suggested and said. In an embarrassed way, I spoke of the silence that existed between her and me, and of how I knew now that it wasn't to change. "We should leave Paris as soon as possible," I said finally. "This creature is too dangerous, and the ones to whom I gave the theatre, they don't know anything other than what they've been taught by him. I say let them have Paris, and let's take the devil's road, to use the old queen's words." I had expected anger from her, and malice towards Armand, but through the whole story she remained calm. "Lestat, there are too many unanswered questions," she said. "I want to know how this old coven started. I want to know all that Armand knows about us. Mother, I am tempted to turn my back on it. I don't care how it started. I wonder if he himself even knows." "I understand, Lestat," she said quietly. "Believe me, I do. When all is said and done, I care less about these creatures than I do about the trees in this forest or the stars overhead. I'd rather study the currents of wind or the patterns in the falling leaves."
"Exactly.
But we mustn't be hasty. The important thing now is for the three of us to remain together. We should go into the city together and prepare slowly for our departure together. And together we must try your plan to rouse Nicholas with the violin."
I wanted to talk about Nicky. I wanted to ask her what lay behind his silence. What could she divine? But the words dried up in my throat. I thought, as I had all along, of her judgment in those first moments. "Disaster, my son." She put her arm around me and led me back towards the tower.
"I don't have to read your mind," she said, "to know what's in your heart. Let's take him to Paris. Let's try to find the Stradivarius."
She stood on tiptoe to kiss me.
"We were on the Devil's Road together before all this happened," she said. "We'll be on it soon again."
It was as easy to take Nicholas into Paris as to lead him in everything else. Like a ghost he mounted his horse and rode alongside of us, only his dark hair and cape seemingly animate, whipped about as they were by the wind. When we fed in the Ile de la Cité, I found I could not watch him hunt or kill. It gave me no hope to see him doing these simple things with the sluggishness of a somnambulist. It proved nothing more than that he could go like this forever. Our silent accomplice, little more than a resuscitated corpse. Yet an unexpected feeling came over me as we moved through the alleyways together. We were not two, but three now. A coven. And if only I could bring him around. But the visit to Roger had to come first. I alone had to confront the lawyer, so I left them to wait only a few doors from his house as I pounded the knocker. I braced myself for the most grueling performance yet of my theatrical career. Well, I was very quickly to learn an important lesson about mortals and their willingness to be convinced that the world is a safe place. Roger was overjoyed to see me. He was so relieved that I was alive and in good health, and still wanted his services, that he was nodding his acceptance before my preposterous explanations had even begun. And this lesson about mortal peace of mind I never forgot. Even if a ghost is ripping a house to pieces, throwing tin pans all over, pouring water on pillows, making clocks chime at all hours, mortals will accept almost any natural explanation offered, no matter how absurd, rather than the obvious supernatural one for what is going on. Also, it became clear almost at once that he believed Gabrielle and I had slipped out of the flat by the servant's door to the bedroom. A nice possibility I hadn't considered before. So all I did about the twisted-up candelabra was mumble something about having been mad with grief when I saw my mother, which he understood right off.
As for the reason for our leaving, well, Gabrielle insisted upon being removed from everyone and taken to a convent, and there she was right now. "Ah, monsieur, it's a miracle, her improvement," I said. "If you could only see her. But never mind. We're going on to Italy immediately with Nicolas de L'Enfant, and we need currency, letters of credit, whatever, and a travelling coach, a huge travelling coach, and a good team of six. You take care of it. Have it all ready by Friday evening early, and write to my father and tell him we're taking my mother to Italy. My father is all right, I presume?" "Yes, yes, of course. I didn't tell him anything but the most reassuring..." "How clever of you. I knew I could trust you. What would I do without you? And what about these rubies? Can you turn them into money for me immediately? And I have here some Spanish coins to sell, quite old, I think." He scribbled like a madman, his doubts and suspicions fading in the heat of my smiles. He was so glad to have something to do. "Hold my property in the Boulevard du Temple vacant," I said. "And of course you'll manage everything for me, and so forth, and so on." My property in the Boulevard du Temple, the hiding place of a ragged and desperate band of vampires, unless Armand had already found them and burnt them up like old costumes. I should find the answer to that question soon enough. I came down the steps, whistling to myself in strictly human fashion, overjoyed that this odious task had been accomplished. And then I realized that Nicky and Gabrielle were nowhere in sight. I stopped and turned around in the street. I saw Gabrielle just at the moment I heard her voice, a young, boyish figure emerging full-blown from an alleyway as if she had just made herself material on the spot.
"Lestat, he's gone. Vanished," she said.
I couldn't answer her. I said something foolish, like, "What do you mean, vanished?" But my thoughts were more or less drowning out the words in my own head. If I had doubted up until this moment that I loved him, I had been lying to myself.
"I turned my back, and it was that quick, I tell you," she said.
She was half aggrieved, half angry. "Did you hear any other—"
"No, nothing. He was simply too quick."
"Yes, if he moved on his own, if he wasn't taken—"
"I would have heard his fear if Armand had taken him," she insisted.
"But does he feel fear? Does he feel anything at all?" I was utterly terrified and utterly exasperated. He'd vanished in a darkness that spread out all around us like a giant wheel from its axis. I think I clenched my fist. I must have made some uncertain little gesture of panic.
"Listen to me," she said. "There are only two things that go round and round in his mind."
"Tell me."
"One is the pyre under Les Innocents, where he was almost burned, and the other is a small theatre, footlights, a stage."
"Renaud's," I said. She and I were archangels together. It didn't take us a quarter of an hour to reach the noisy boulevard and to move through its raucous crowd past the neglected facade of Renaud's and back to the stage door. The boards had all been ripped down and the locks broken, but I heard no sound of Eleni or the others as we slipped quietly into the hallway and went round the back of the stage. No one here. Perhaps Armand had gathered his children home after all, and that was my doing because I would not take them in. Nothing but the jungle of props, the great painted scrims of night and day, and hill and dale, and the open dressing rooms, those crowded little closets where here and there a mirror glared in the light that seeped through the open door we had left behind. Then Gabrielle's hand tightened on my sleeve. She gestured towards the wings proper, and I knew by her face that it wasn't the other ones. Nicky was there. I went to the side of the stage. The velvet curtain was drawn back to both sides, and I could see his dark figure plainly in the orchestra pit. He was sitting in his old place, his hands folded in his lap. He was facing me, but he didn't notice me. He was staring off as he had done all along. And the memory came back to me of Gabrielle's strange words, the night after I had made her, that she could not get over the sensation that she had died and could affect nothing in the mortal world. He appeared, that lifeless and that translucent. He was the still, expressionless spectre one almost stumbles over in the shadows of the haunted house, all but melded with the dusty furnishings, the fright that is worse perhaps than any other kind. I looked to see if the violin was there, on the floor or against his chair. And when I saw that it wasn't, I thought, well, there is still a chance. "Stay here and watch," I said to Gabrielle. but my heart was knocking in my throat when I looked up at the darkened theatre, when I let myself breathe in the old scents. Why did you have to bring us here, Nicky, to this haunted place? But then, who am I to ask that? I had come back, had I not? I lighted the first candle I found in the old prima donna's dressing room. Open pots of paint were scattered everywhere, and there were many discarded costumes on the hooks. All the rooms I passed were full of cast-off clothing, forgotten combs and brushes, withered flowers still in the vases, powder spilled on the floor. I thought of Eleni and the others again, and I realized that the faintest smell of Les Innocents lingered here, and I saw very distinct naked footprints in the spilled powder. Yes, they'd come in. And they had lighted candles, too, hadn't they? Because the smell of the wax was too fresh. Whatever the case, they hadn't entered my old dressing room, the room that Nicky and I had shared before every performance. It was locked still. And when I broke open the door, I got an ugly shock. The room was exactly the way I'd left it. It was clean and orderly, with the mirror polished, and it was filled with my belongings as it had been on the last night I had been here. There was an old coat on the hook, the cast-off I'd worn from the country, and a pair of wrinkled boots, and my pots of paint in perfect order, and my wig, which I had worn only at the theatre, on its wooden head. Letters from Gabrielle in a little stack, the old copies of English and French newspapers in which the play had been mentioned, and a bottle of wine still half full with a dried cork. And there in the darkness, beneath the marble dressing table, partly covered by a bundled black coat, lay a shiny violin case. It was not the one we'd carried all the way from home with us. No. It must hold the precious gift I'd bought for him with the coin of the realm after, the Stradivarius violin. I bent down and opened the lid. It was the beautiful instrument, all right, delicate and darkly lustrous, and lying here among all these unimportant things. I wondered whether Eleni and the others would have taken it had they come into this room. Would they have known what it could do? I set down the candle for a moment and took it out carefully, and I tightened the horsehair of the bows as I'd seen Nicky do 1,000 times. And then I brought the instrument and the candle back to the stage again, and I bent down and commenced to light the long string of candle footlights. Gabrielle watched me impassively. Then she came to help me. She lit one candle after another, and then lighted the sconce in the wings. It seemed Nicky stirred. But maybe it was only the growing illumination on his profile, the soft light that emanated out from the stage into the darkened hall. The deep folds of the velvet came alive everywhere. The ornate little mirrors affixed to the front of the gallery and the loge became lights themselves. Beautiful, this little place. Our place. The portal to the world for us as mortal beings, and the portal finally to hell. When I was finished, I stood on the boards looking at the gilded railings, the new chandelier that hung from the ceiling, and up at the arch overhead, with its masks of comedy and tragedy, like two faces stemming from the same neck. It seemed so much smaller when it was empty, this house. No theatre in Paris seemed larger when it was full. Outside was the low thunder of the boulevard traffic, tiny human voices rising now and then like sparks over the general hum. A heavy carriage must have passed then, because everything within the theatre shivered slightly, the candle flames against their reflectors, the giant stage curtain gathered to right and left, the scrim behind of a finely painted garden with clouds overhead. I went past Nicky, who had never once looked up at me, and down the little stairs behind him, and came towards him with the violin. Gabrielle stood back in the wings again, her small face cold but patient. She rested against the beam beside her in the easy manner of a strange, long-haired man. I lowered the violin over Nicky's shoulder and held it in his lap. I felt him move as if he had taken a great breath. The back of his head pressed against me, and slowly he lifted his left hand to take the neck of the violin, and he took the bow with his right. I knelt and put my hands on his shoulders. I kissed his cheek. No human scent. No human warmth. Sculpture of my Nicholas. "Play it," I whispered. "Play it here just for us." Slowly he turned to face me, and for the first time since the moment of the dark trick,